For those of you who have a bulletin, you'll notice that my sermon title is Summer of Faith. So would you say that you have been experiencing sensory overload lately? What about information overload? TMI. How many have experienced TMI? Since Memorial Day weekend, our already overstressed systems have been dealing with the stress, anxiety, and fears of COVID-19, and now expected to contend with protests and its byproducts, being labeled as social unrest and systemic racism. Back on June 11th, approximately 2 weeks ago, it's amazing how it seems like it's forever, but it was only yesterday. Back on June 11th, six blocks of Seattle were taken by protesters establishing a new sovereign nation. That would be number 196. There are 195 in the world. This would be 196. Known as CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. When asked how she was going to respond to what was known as CHAZ then and now is known as CHOP, the Capitol Hill Occupation Protest, when referring to it, she called it a block party atmosphere. This is the mayor of Seattle. When she was on CNN, Chris Cuomo asked, "How long do you think Seattle in those few blocks looks like this?" Mayor Jenny Durkin responded, "I don't know. We could have a summer of love." After three shootings, two of them being teenagers, the mayor has now walked back her comments, claiming they were said in jest and probably shouldn't have even been said at all. Now, the groups behind the anarchy and the chaos wasn't to tear down statues providing historical perspective for our nation, both bad and good. Now, included in this litany of statues are those belonging to what are identified as the white Jesus. So not only is George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln, now we're talking about statues of Jesus. Social justice activist Sean King has appeared at the center of the hot-button controversy yet again, this time for comments he made on Twitter, saying that statues of Jesus Christ that portray him as a white European should be torn down. He says, "Yes, I think the statues of a white European they claim is Jesus should also come down." He said earlier this week, "They are a form of white supremacy. Always have been. In the Bible, when the family of Jesus wanted to hide and blend in, guess where they went? Egypt," he said, "not Denmark." And then he says, "Tear them down." Sean King was once a pastor. He resigned from the courageous church that he had started, and it was cited that he resigned based on personal stress and disillusionment. We do not know specifically what he was disillusioned about, causing him to resign from the church he had established. However, in his most recent comment is any indication we might have an idea. One might call Sean King more activist than pastor, although there is a flock that is following him and hearing his voice. But it is not intended to preach the gospel. Quite the contrary. Don't be surprised if at some point you hear about another group rearing its ugly heads again. The group being Black Hebrew Israelites. This is falling within their lane of thought. I've talked about them in the past. Yet the tearing down of white Jesus statues may sound like it's something we might support, but not for the reasons that they're talking about. He's not in any way saying, "Well, let's tear down these white Jesus statues and proclaim Yeshua, the Jewish Messiah." I would say that's not probably part of his intent. So I give you a sampling of what has been transpiring. Why did I do this? To aggravate you even more? No. Ultimately, it was to provide you with context, not to stress you out not to stress you out any further than you already are, but to bring you to a place where we can move forward. Part of what I wanted to share was influenced by the Seattle mayor's comments about the summer of love. Friday, I was in bed contemplating, what was I going to share with you today? Sometimes I don't get it until Saturday morning. Sometimes I get it weeks before. It's like, okay, well, there's a progression here. So Friday, I'm wondering, okay, what am I going to talk about? Because I have a backup plan if nothing else comes. So I was lying there. At this point, nothing had really sprung forth. That was until these words appeared in my mind. Summer of faith. My first thoughts were, what does this mean? What does this even look like? How do I wrap my hands around this or my mind? I immediately correlated it to the words of Mayor Durkan, Summer of Love comment. This is something that she implied would last the entire summer. We've heard of a summer of love before, and she was alluding to the summer of love of 1967. Keeping in mind, don't know how she draw the two together, but anyways. The first verse that came to mind when I started formulating this, or the pieces started coming together, was 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7. For we live by trust, not by what we see. This verse is the end of the passage offering a conclusion, a statement regarding how we are to live. Here is the full context of this passage, starting in verse 4. Yes, while we are in this body, we groan with the sense of being oppressed. It is not so much that we want to take something off, but rather to put something on over it, so that what must die may be swallowed up by the life. Moreover, it is God who has prepared us for this very thing. And as a pledge, he has given us his Spirit. So we are always confident. We know that so long as we are at home in the body, we are away from our home with the Lord. For we live by trust, not by what we see. In its full context, Shaul is conveying to the Corinthians, while we are in this current body, not our incorruptible bodies, we are to remain confident in Yeshua. We are to take hold of his words and not let go, no matter what is going on around us. When Shaul wrote this letter to the congregation at Corinth, they were also dealing with sensory overload. You had the dark pagan influences of the culture and the oppressive Roman Empire lording over them. Believers were not highly favored in these cultures. Let me read an excerpt from the Complete Jewish Study Bible with regards to Shaul's letters. In 1 Corinthians, Shaul wondered whether the community divided by controversies sided with him or with other leaders. Controversies. Imagine that. They existed then, they exist today. If some things never change, that would be one of them. Would the Corinthians hear him out and invoke needed discipline? By the time he wrote this second letter to the congregation at Corinth, around 56 of the Common Era, matters seem to have been resolved in his favor. Shaul was pleased to learn that they had accepted his correction, were remedying deficient situations accordingly, and were again kindly disposed toward him. So in other words, that first letter, which did not mince words, actually did what it was intended to do, provide correction. He corrected their path, so to speak. Then the commentary goes on, the question that plagued Shaul bothers all congregational leaders. Leaders are forever disconcerted by contention, abandonment, and incessant critiques. But They are also greeted by offsetting expressions of affection, appreciation, and acceptance. In 2 Corinthians, it is clear that Shaul has learned that the Corinthians accept him, but one key question still remains. Will they accept the responsibility to stand behind Jewish followers in Yeshua and in Israel? A concern that was prominent then, but doesn't seem so much now today. But that's another matter. A concern so foundational when you read Shaul's writings that one must wonder, where and when did it all change? Again, this is a sermon for another day. But now I want to focus on the summer of faith and getting to that. So in this world, we are not to walk by sight, even though that is the basic requirement when going from place to place. It is how we navigate, how we assess. Here Shaul is conveying to the reader, don't assess your position with Yeshua with that which is going on around you. In other words, compartmentalize them. Keep them separate. You remain secure in Yeshua regardless of what's going on around you. Yes, there is chaos going on around us today. Yes, there is ultimately an attack of our faith that has been further intensified. How do you avoid your head, or how do you avoid from your head spinning and getting dizzy from everything going on today? Have you ever wondered when a figure skater spins, she doesn't get dizzy, or he doesn't get dizzy? There is some foundation here that we can glean from. I have an excerpt from an article in Scientific America. I have a full link to the article as well. You can read it in its entirety. When we spin on an amusement park ride or a dance floor, we often become disoriented, even dizzy. So how do professional athletes, particularly figure skaters, who spin at incredible speeds, avoid losing their balance? The short answer is training. Okay, that's all we have to do. Enough said. No. But to really grasp why figure skaters can twirl without getting dizzy requires an understanding of the vestibular system. Vestibular. It's okay, so some of you I know are health professionals. Hopefully I pronounced that right. It's the apparatus in our inner ear that helps us keep upright. In other words, it's our balancing mechanism. This system contains special sensory nerve cells that can detect the speed and direction at which our heads move. These sensors are tightly coupled with our eye movements and with our perception of our body's position and motion through space. For instance, if you rotate your head to the right while your eyes remain focused on an object to the left at the same speed. So there's a corresponding action-reaction going on within you to adjust, to make adjustments. This involuntary response allows you to stay focused on a stationary object. Spinning is more complicated. The article goes on. When we move our head during a spin, our eyes start to move in the opposite direction, but reach their limit before our head completely turns a full 360. So our eyes flick back to a new starting position mid-spin, and the motion repeats as we rotate. When our head rotation triggers this automatic, repetitive eye movement called nystagmus, I think is how it's pronounced, we get dizzy. So we get dizzy from a term called nystagmus, where our eyes go like this as we're trying to focus on something as we move. Skaters suppress the dizziness by learning how to counteract nystagmus with another type of eye movement called optokinetic nystagmus. Optokinetic nystagmus occurs in the opposite direction of the nystagmus. So if your eyes are going one way, the optokinetic compensates and goes the other way and allows us to track a moving object, such as a train whizzing by with our eyes while our head remains in place. As the first few cars of the train move out of view, our eyes jump back to their initial position to follow the next few. So if you've ever been watching something in motion, how do we do that? Your eyes are doing something in between and your brain is triggering what they're doing. Consider it code. Your computer brain is processing code in order to function properly. There's an automation process for this as well, but I'm not going to go into that. So skaters can train themselves to engage this opposing eye movement when they rotate to offset the nystagmus and keep the world from spinning. So we're going to take a page out of figure skaters. It's interesting that this vestibular system, the apparatus in our inner ear, is where our balancing comes from. Our ability to balance is attained through the system in the inner ear. It is contained within our hearing system. So the dizziness for all that is going on around us can also be traced back to our hearing system. So the dizziness you're experiencing from everything you've been hearing, making your head spin, in essence, you're hearing too much. But there's a remedy. They call it optokinetic nystagmus. I'm going to take it a step further. I'm going to call it spiritual optokinetic nystagmus. In other words, we have to maintain our focus. John chapter 14, verse 1. Yeshua made this statement. Don't let yourselves be disturbed. Trust in me and trust in God. Why does he make such a statement? If this is truly sequential, at the end of chapter 13, in preparation for Passover, with he and his Talmidim, Yeshua tells Kepha he will deny him 3 times. Yeshua is in essence countering Kepha's future action with a seed of faith, planted then to take root, grow, and flourish later. That is when the light, Yeshua's light, will cause it to grow, flourish, produce much fruit later on. Yeshua then goes on further, ultimately establishing not just a connection, but a union of echad, of complex unity. Yeshua said, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. The wordplay of the rabbi is unmistakable here, yet many miss it. Yet apparently some miss this connection, namely Philip. In verse 8, Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it will be enough for us. Yeshua replied to him, have I been with you so long without you knowing me? And he says this to Philip, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. So how can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am united with the Father and the Father united with me? What I am telling you, I am not saying on my own initiative. The Father living in me is doing his own works. So something so apparent didn't seem so apparent. If even his Talmidim needed further understanding of Yeshua, even in the midst of the many miracles and teachings he had done for the last 3 years, we ourselves can most certainly benefit from more as well. The world is known to devour its inhabitants. Today is no different. Hebrews chapter 10 begins with the following. For the Torah has in it a shadow of the good things to come, but not the actual manifestation of the originals. Therefore, it can never, by means of the same sacrifice repeated endlessly, year after year, bring to the goal those who approach the holy place to offer them. Having concluded Hebrews chapter 9 and the reality that Yeshua is the ultimate atoning sacrifice, not merely covering, but rather absolving us from the wages of sin being death. The writer is expanding on the significance of Yeshua's sacrifice and its relation to Torah. In other words, there is no other sacrifice available. This is it. Don't waste it. Don't neglect it. Don't ignore it. The writer is preparing a context for what the reader is about to convey later on. So I want to share this passage of Hebrews, chapter 10, starting in verse 26. Because it's talking about our relationship with God. And it says, verse 26, "For if we deliberately continue to sin after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but only the terrifying prospect of judgment, of raging fire that will consume the enemies." Someone who disregards the Torah of Moses is put to death without mercy on the word of two or three witnesses. Think how much worse will be the punishment deserved by someone who has trampled underfoot the Son of God, who is treated as something common, the blood of the covenant which made him holy, and who has insulted the Spirit, giver of God's grace. For the one we know is the one who said, "Vengeance is my responsibility, I will repay," and then said, "Adonai will judge his people." Making the connection, the writer of Hebrews is making the connection between Yeshua and God as relating to Torah. In other words, the one whom you have faith in is the one whom you are to glean from. Because the last verse, verse 31, before I get into the next session, it is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. That is, if you have gone away from him. In other words, moving away from him ultimately is denying Yeshua, but ultimately ignoring his word, his lifestyle that he wants you and encourages you to partake in. Because then in verse 32 it says, "But remember the earlier days, when after you had received the light, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings." This isn't before, this is afterwards. After you have received the light, after Yeshua has been revealed to you, what happened? Everything got better. No. That's when the challenges started. You endured a hard struggle with sufferings. Sometimes you were publicly disgraced and persecuted, while at other times you stood loyally by those who were treated this way. For you shared the sufferings of those who have been put in prison. Also, when your possessions were seized, you accepted it gladly, since you knew that what you possessed was better and would last forever. Not talking about the possessions here, but what you possess that God has given you as an inheritance. So don't, verse 35, so don't throw away that courage of yours, which carries with it such a great reward. For you need to hold out, so that by having done what God wills, you will receive what he has promised. For there is so little time. This is 2,000 years ago. There is so little time. The one coming will indeed come. He will not delay. But the person who is righteous will live his life by trusting. Doesn't this sound like what Shaul was saying in Corinthians? And if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. However, we are not the kind who shrink back. We are not the kind who are destroyed. On the contrary, we keep trusting to preserve our lives. So keep this in mind. This word is for you. It was written for you, for this time. Whenever you come into such a time as this, so to speak, our prospects will likely get worse rather than better. The world hates Yeshua, and by association, it hates us also. And yet the writer of Hebrews is telling us, don't throw away what you have been given, succumbing to the pressure of the world, when the promise given you is so much greater. Are you going to succumb to a little pressure and give up what you can't even fathom? 2 weeks ago, I talked about enduring until the end. This week, I am encouraging you to continue to persevere. How will you persevere? Just as when bands tour, they have a name for their tour, identifying it, thus potentially making it iconic. That is why today I am introducing to you Kehillah Portland's Summer of Faith Tour. On this tour, we will pick up where Hebrews 10:38 leaves off. That being Hebrews 11. Trusting as being confident of what we hope for, convinced about things we do not see. It was for this that the scripture attested the merit of the people of old. We will tour those past stalwarts of faith, Adonai's Mount Rushmore of trust, and we won't even have to leave the gym to go. Now more than ever, you need to delve deep into the canyon of faith, immersing yourselves in the rich history of Adonai's people, their struggles, but most importantly, their failures and triumphs. This is not a congregation that cancels history, but embraces it. No need to pack your bags, but rather pack your Bibles, because our tour will wind through it. My desire is at the end of our tour, we reach our destination of immovable faith, absent of doubt and fear, transcending the climate of our nation and this world with the encouragement as conveyed by the writer of Hebrews. For you shared the sufferings of those who had been put in prison, but also when your possessions were seized, you accepted it gladly, since you knew that what you possessed was better and would last forever. So don't throw away that courage of yours, which carries with it such a great reward. For you need to hold out so that by having done what God wills, you may receive what He has promised. The one coming will indeed come. He will not delay. If that was 2,000 years ago, how much sooner is His appearance now? So the writer of Hebrews is encouraging you to persevere, to endure, to remember the promises that God gave you. And it's in essence, you have a receipt, but you haven't claimed it yet, because the window to submit your receipt hasn't been opened yet. So you're holding on to the promise until you redeem it. It's already been redeemed, but you haven't been able to receive it yet. Because in the warning at the end, and I'm repeating Hebrews 10:34 through 39, but the person who is righteous will live his life by trusting. That would have been fine. But then he conveys, and if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. What's the response upon receiving the promise and redeeming it? Well done, good and faithful servant. I will not be pleased with him. But then, the last statement, which is basically the go team statement. However, we are not the kind who shrink back and are destroyed. On the contrary, we keep trusting, thus preserve our lives. So the question is, you may have endured a lot. You may have been dizzied by all that's going on around you. But the thing that I didn't talk about, that I've talked about in the past, what is this all but noise meant to distract you, meant to discourage you, meant to take your eyes off the mark? So our summer tour beginning next week, our Summer of Faith tour beginning next week, I should say, we'll look at those whose faith we can glean from, whose trust we can look at. And I'm not just saying their victories, but their failures as well. They were human. They're in the same position we are. Doubt creeps in. But what does God do? God lifts them up, dusts them off, and pushes them forward. So I want you to keep this in mind, because I believe it's important that we truly need to embrace those that came before us, who endured many of the things that we have endured, but have also endured far greater than we have endured yet. So it's not just a question of dealing with the now, but dealing with the potential of what can come. So keep this in mind as we begin our tour next week. So if everybody please rise.